provision restricting the timing of the General Assembly's consideration of a federal constitutional amendment. There was good reason, Bond reminded his colleagues. The 14th Amendment, giving all rights and protections of citizenship to the freed slaves, had been rammed down Tennessee's throat at the close of the Civil War, forcibly thrust through the legislature in 1866 by the radical Republican governor, the despised William Parson Brownlow. The legislature acted against the opinion and sentiment of an overwhelming majority of the people of Tennessee, Bond recited, reading the resolution text in his practiced courtroom style. The legislators didn't ask the people, the white people, if they wanted the 14th Amendment, he emphasized. It was forced upon them. With that infuriating incident in mind, Tennesseans rewrote their state constitution in 1870, requiring legislators to face the public in an election before they considered any federal constitutional amendments. Bond acknowledged that the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that the clause stood in conflict with the U.S. Constitution, and he didn't dispute that ruling, but instead nimbly sidestepped the issue with a novel approach. Resolved. The General Assembly must take no action on ratification until the voice of the people could be heard. The popular sentiment on ratification should be expressed by both men and women in mass meetings held in every county seat of the state at noon on Saturday, August 21st, a postponement of nearly 2 weeks. A chairman in each county would then report the prevailing opinion of its citizens to the district's delegates in the legislature by August 24th. And the legislators could then properly vote the will of their constituents. This would delay and diminish any chance for timely ratification. The chamber erupted. Shouts, cheers, and protests on the floor and in the galleries, everyone on their feet. Reporters likened the reaction to a loud breaking storm, thunderheads that had been building for weeks finally splitting open. The antis applauded the resolution's brilliant stroke of promising a measure of populist democracy while delivering the desired delay, perhaps forever, of ratification. The Sofs were duly alarmed. The mass meeting idea was a candy-coated and very palatable excuse for legislators to do nothing. By House rules, the resolution should be held over to the next day for a second reading, but Speaker Walker made a quick, deft move, ruling to allow a suspension of the rules, placing the resolution immediately before the House. The hot debate began. Faces flushed and voices rose.
The members of this legislature must determine whether they are men or weaklings, shouted Leonidas L.D. Miller of Chattanooga, a firm suffrage supporter who understood the seductive danger of the bond resolution. Nothing could be fairer to the people or legislators of Tennessee than this resolution, Billy Bond responded dismissively. This measure is not meant as an obstruction, Frank Hall, one of the resolution's co-sponsors, concurred, but to sound out popular sentiment.
Miller shook off their rationalizations.
Make no mistake, he insisted. The authors of this resolution to defer are in their hearts bitterly opposed to suffrage ratification, and the purpose of it is not to secure the will of the people, but to delay action and defeat the ratification of suffrage in Tennessee. Are you afraid to let the people express themselves? Bond shot back. Do you believe they will go against you, and that you will not be able to put over a measure they do not want?
How much declaring do you need? Miller countered. The state conventions of both parties had declared for ratification, the national conventions, too.
And far and above the political party appeals, cried Miller, comes the voice of the womanhood of America calling for justice long overdue.
The Sufs in the gallery cheered.
Will you yield to the appeal of womanhood, or the insidious influence at work to defeat the measure. To throw this question back upon the people will show cowardice,
Miller boomed. While the debate unfolded, Ann Dudley delicately circulated around the chamber. It was a safe assumption that just the lovely sight of her would remind certain legislators that they'd made a promise to support ratification, and for those who seemed to have already forgotten those vows, she could refresh their faltering memories with a sweet, sharp nudge. These were men she knew well, both politically and socially, and she could approach them in a certain easy way, a way they understood. She'd already pledged the delegates from Nashville and surrounding Davidson County, and they were all rock solid for ratification, they promised. She'd gotten to know many of the legislators during the State House suffrage skirmishes of the past years, while others were friends or colleagues of her husband Guilford, a prosperous Nashville insurance man who could amiably kid his pals about not being manly enough to support their wives in their desire for enfranchisement. Some of the men she saw in the chamber this morning had jeered her in the early years of the Nashville Equal Suffrage League, when she led that first public parade, with 2,000 proper Nashville matrons dressed in white with yellow sashes, making a spectacle of themselves on the streets of the city. These men had been taken aback when Anne, in a public debate, had smashed the anti's trusty rationale that women did not have the right to vote because they were not required to bear arms in wartime. With her poignant reply, "Yes, but women bear armies." And even the bitterest anti-Solon had to admire Anne's sang-froid when that bomb was tossed through a window while she addressed a suffrage meeting in 1913. "Is that an anti-suffrage bomb?" she'd asked calmly, peering over the podium, pausing only a few beats. It didn't explode, so she continued on with her speech. Yet today Anne Dudley seemed nervous. Mrs. Catt was professing confidence, but last night Andrew Todd had confided to the Suffs that he thought the Senate might pull through on ratification, but the House was lost. On the north side of the Capitol, the Senate was also in session, and the mood there was almost as edgy as in the lower house. Speaker Todd wanted to speed things along, allow no time for disruptions or space for delay, but he was struggling to stay on track. The galleries of the jewel-box-like Senate chamber were also packed, though the observers were quieter than their comrades in the House. 16 massive Tennessee marble columns, each hauled in one piece by slaves and convicts up Capitol Hill, surrounded the 33 desks of the senators like silent sentinels. Joint Resolution Number 1, providing for the adoption of the 19th Amendment, emerged from its overnight layover onto the day's docket. There was no attempt to introduce the kind of mass-meeting delay tactic that was being debated across the hall. Anti-strategists were waiting to learn the outcome of that ploy before bringing it to the Senate. But the antis were prepared to strike in other ways. Andrew Todd moved that the ratification resolution be referred for consideration to the Senate Committee on Constitutional Amendments, whose members were known to be friendly toward ratification. Herschel Candler immediately jumped up in protest. It should more properly be sent to the Judiciary Committee, he argued. The Judiciary Committee members, it was understood, were less favorably inclined toward suffrage. Candler did not like being railroaded like this. He'd had enough of such tactics this morning. First, he'd received an insulting telegram from Republican Chairman Hayes, telling him that for the good of the party, the good of the country, the good of the whole world, he should violate his oath of office to ratify. Such pompous claptrap was best ignored. Then he had to sit through another Republican caucus, where the same hollow arguments were pounded into the table. The state party leaders wanted everyone to file into a straight line like stupid sheep and swear to ratify on the orders of Hayes, Harding, and God. He wasn't having any of it. He was his own man. The ratification resolution should go to judiciary, Candler insisted, with fire in his voice. In the House, Seth Walker stepped down from the speaker's chair onto the floor to advocate for the bond resolution. There was a stir in the galleries and fidgety anticipation among the delegates. Walker straightened his back and squared his shoulders, a tall, commanding presence in the well of the chamber.
"This resolution carries out the spirit of the law as enacted by our forefathers," Walker began.
"Remember," he told his colleagues, "the 14th Amendment was imposed upon the South by the vengeful Union states and forced upon Tennessee by a legislature composed of Yankee carpetbaggers who ignored the will of the people." He did not need to mention that accepting the 14th Amendment was the price for Tennessee's readmission to the Union, nor did he choose to mention the legislators who tried to slip out of the State House to avoid voting on the amendment, prevented only by the gunshots of the Union soldiers on guard. Those bullet holes were still obvious on the marble staircase leading down from the House chamber. The esteemed forefathers at the Constitutional Convention of 1870 corrected this procedure, prevented it from happening again, by writing that essential clause, "In letters that stand immortal," Walker pontificated. Tennessee then rejected the 15th Amendment, the one guaranteeing the voting rights of the freed slaves, and the General Assembly passed a joint resolution condemning federal imposition of black suffrage upon the states.
"The Constitution of this great state cannot be played with for political purposes," Walker insisted.
If the legislature was being forced, by a Supreme Court ruling, to act before an election, this resolution was a suitable and legal antidote, he explained.
"We want to get an expression from the people, for that is the spirit of the Constitution of 1870.
Walker declared to red-rosed applause. Josephine Pearson watched the argument from her gallery seat. She'd never seen anything quite like this. Mr. Vertrees had not permitted her to set foot in the State House during the 1917 and 1919 debates, so this was her first opportunity to watch the legislature in action. Here were the brave anti-men of Tennessee taking their stand, upholding the honor of the South, and she was so proud of them, especially that young, very handsome Seth Walker. She had suffered so long on account of her opposition to suffrage, lost so many friends, been snubbed too many times, turned down for jobs and appointments, and it was obvious to her why. Because she was a proud anti, willing to stand up for what she believed. On the desk of each legislator was the latest set of anti-materials, which Pearson had helped to compose and distribute. She thought the new advocacy piece was especially fine.
"Can anybody terrorize Tennessee manhood?" it screamed in big, bold type. "The Susan B. Anthony Amendment will never be ratified if Tennessee representatives do their duty now."
Tennessee had the opportunity to save America, the Jeremiad announced. "The federal suffrage drive is dead if Tennessee will answer the call of her own constitution, her own people, and that of her sister southern states." Face down the suffrage blackmailers and card indexers, the piece implored the Tennessee delegates. Ignore those who say woman suffrage is bound to come in an attempt to weaken your resistance. Recognize that those distant party leaders and candidates in Ohio and Washington don't understand the South's local conditions and the threat of Negro domination. They don't see the looming danger of another era of Southern Reconstruction brought on by federal control of elections. Only you, the legislators of Tennessee, stand in the way of calamity. The men who vote against ratification will go down in American history as the saviors of our form of government and the true defenders of womanhood, motherhood, the family, and the state, the document promised. For Pearson and her allies, All this was neither hyperbole nor exaggeration. It expressed a deep truth and revealed a pernicious danger that was not being taken seriously enough. The nation had just fought to protect Europe and itself from the despotism of the Hun, but now the gravest threat to the American Republic was coming from within. From this federal amendment and its grave ramifications, racial, social, and political. It fell to the Antis, standing firm in Nashville, to safeguard the South's democracy. Thomas Riddick, House floor leader for ratification, jumped into the debate. Many of the attorneys present had heard Riddick speak in a courtroom, but never before in the legislature. This was his debut performance. "This resolution was ridiculous," Riddick railed. "A legal sham and a logistic nightmare." Riddick's eyes blazed and his mustache bobbed up and down on his lip as he spoke. Not only was it simply a variation on the ratification referenda the Supreme Court had already struck down, and an outrageous shirking of a legislator's responsibilities, but these so-called mass conventions could never accurately gauge the public sentiment. How would popular opinion be measured? By who showed up first? By who yelled the loudest? And who would interpret and report what was expressed? There was too much room for manipulation and possibly fraud. The Suffs did a double take as they saw Governor Roberts appear in the back of the chamber. Sweating through his shirt and crumpled jacket, he was following the debate, consulting with Riddick and Miller, and writing strategy notes to certain delegates, dispatching the missives to their desks. He called some lawmakers over to his side for a few hushed words, an intense back and forth, then a pat on the back. Roberts had finally spoken with Governor Cox on the telephone, told him things were under control, and had spent all last night and early morning working on iffy Democratic legislators. Now he was wrestling on the floor of the House. He was working. Abby Milton saw the governor at the back of the room, and saw her stepson, George Milton Jr., scribbling away in the press gallery. Young George, barely 25, was an eager, if callow, young reporter for his father's newspaper, finally assigned to a big story. He chronicled every event with gusto, as if he were a war correspondent or a sports reporter at an important race. He liked to relate who was jockeying for position, whether the red or yellow rose was drooping that day in the War of the Roses. And now he was taking notes on how Governor Roberts was rolling up his sleeves and doing his darndest to stop this delay resolution. The Milton family had worked strenuously to defeat Roberts in the primary, putting the editorial pages of their Chattanooga News into the service of his opponent, but Roberts's very visible efforts on behalf of the amendment were causing them to view the governor in a new light. Sue White and Anita Politzer, standing at the edge of the chamber, did not share this sunshine view of Governor Roberts. They still suspected that he was double-dealing. "He's acting as if he's working for ratification," Politzer reported to Alice Paul, "but his own men are working against us." Politzer also believed Roberts was giving inaccurate information to Governor Cox, in an effort to keep the candidate from putting more pressure on state Democrats, or coming to Tennessee himself. When Politzer mentioned the possibility of Cox coming to Nashville to help push for ratification, Roberts had visibly blanched. Miss Paul took Politzer's suspicions seriously, and issued new instructions to her organizers in Nashville. Backpedal on accusations against the liquor and railroad industries, and instead emphasize the responsibility borne by Cox and Roberts if ratification should fail. The sinister forces charge was just too hard to prove concretely, even if true, and journalists were tiring of it. Holding the Democrats accountable was more comfortable and profitable territory for the Woman's Party. Keep the pressure on. And talk to the wire service reporters in Nashville, Paul instructed her lieutenants. Make sure they quote us rather than Mrs. Catt. It's important for fundraising purposes that the Woman's Party receive credit and public attention for its work in Tennessee. Paul had already purchased a Pullman car ticket for Nashville. As the House debate wore on, Joe Hanover of Shelby asked to be recognized by Speaker Walker. "I wish to speak against this resolution," he announced. The Suffs paid particular attention to the words of this young attorney who so earnestly and publicly had come to their side. He'd made that heart-rending speech during the limited suffrage debates last year about the American dream and the power of the vote, and his sincerity seemed to sway several on-the-fence delegates. Even though he'd resigned from the legislature to take a good job as a Shelby County district attorney, he decided he must return to the State House to help get ratification through, campaigned to regain his seat, and here he was. During the past few nights, he'd begun attending the Suff strategy sessions in Mrs. Catt's room, impressing them all, especially Mrs. Catt, with his political acumen and strategic vision, and his passion for their fight. Hanover did not have Confederate pedigree or Tennessee forefathers. He was an immigrant whose parents had brought him as a boy to America to escape the pogroms against Jews in their native Poland. This was the land of opportunity, they told him, the land of equality and freedom, and he believed every word. He lived the American dream. Knight Law School, a fledgling legal practice, a seat in the legislature. But women, his own mother, didn't share in that equality, not as full citizens, and that seemed wrong, plainly un-American to Hanover. Now he was in a position to do something about it.
"The people of Tennessee have already passed upon suffrage," he declared. "The real voice of the people has already been heard in the expression of both party platforms."
Hanover swiveled to look directly at Walker.
"My colleagues, Mr. Bond and Mr. Walker, were both members of the Democratic State Convention in June, which wrote into its platform that we stand for woman suffrage in Tennessee," Hanover exclaimed, and suffragists all through the chamber burst into sustained applause.
Mrs. Catt was not in the chamber. In accordance with the new Suff strategy, she was to remain invisible. So she was sitting in her hotel room, quite miserable, staring at the Capitol cupola through an open window. Harriet Upton and Marjorie Schuller were with her, watching Catt closely for any sign that she was having trouble breathing, that the hot air and stress might be affecting her heart. As they sat in Catt's room, they could hear occasional cheers or shouts coming from the State House through the open window, but they had to wait for a breathless young messenger to run down from Capitol Hill and knock on Catt's door to deliver the latest report of what was actually happening in the House and Senate chambers. In the Senate, Herschel Candler's motion to refer the ratification resolution to the Judiciary Committee hung in the air for just an instant before a pro-suffrage lawmaker made a counter-move to table it. "It was the custom of the Senate," the senator protested, "to allow the Speaker to refer resolutions to the committee he thought proper. That custom should be respected." The tabling measure was brought to a vote. It carried by a slim majority, and the Suffs were mightily relieved. Todd announced definitively that the ratification resolution would go to the Committee on Constitutional Amendments. This was a setback for Candler and his anti-colleagues, but they did not make any further fuss. It was just the first skirmish. There was time. In the front row of the House chamber, Edward Oldham slowly rose to his feet to speak in favor of the mass meetings. He was a 74-year-old farmer, and he was, he reminded his colleagues once again, a proud Confederate veteran. Oldham was only 16 when he volunteered for the Tennessee Cavalry, and he served for the full duration of the war. Now, with his clipped silver beard and bare forehead, he bore a striking resemblance to his hero, Robert E. Lee.
"The people of Lauderdale, whom I represent, do not want suffrage for women," Oldham pronounced confidently.
"Woman suffrage will cause divorce and dissatisfaction in many homes," he continued, and was a menace to family life. The people did not want it.
Is there any fair-minded man who is afraid to submit this question to the people he represents?
Oldham challenged his colleagues. Man after man took his turn recommending or denouncing the mass meeting resolution, but no one mentioned whether black citizens would be allowed to take part in these meetings. The answer was undoubtedly no. The delegate stood in the chamber just where Frankie Pierce had stood barely 3 months before, pledging the support of the Negro Women of Nashville to the League of Women Voters, outlining her legislative goals, the programs her community needed. Catherine Kenny, who'd invited Pierce to the Capitol that day, had been so pleased with her presentation and so impressed by the organizational ability Pierce had displayed in last fall's municipal elections in getting the black women to the polls, that she took real pride in this new alliance the women of Nashville had forged. It seemed to bring to life Mrs. Katz's concept of the League as an organization for all women voters. All colors, all creeds, all political parties. For Democratic Catholic women, for Republican black women, all together. But Frankie Pierce was not in the galleries this morning with all the other Tennessee suffs. She couldn't be. Her presence could not help win ratification from the men of the legislature. It could only hurt. She wouldn't be allowed to sit with the white suffs in the gallery anyway. Inviting her was simply out of the question. The state party leaders were arrayed around the House chamber, in constant motion, pulling any strings they could reach. Kenneth McKellar was wielding the message that had arrived from DNC Chairman George White that morning, urging Tennessee delegates to ratify. Republican leaders were impressing upon their delegates, especially the wavering ones, the importance of the special 5-page telegram they'd just received from Will Hayes of the RNC. Hayes had spent hours the previous night convincing a reluctant Warren Harding to agree to send direct notes to the list of resistant Tennessee Republicans that party leaders Ben Hooper and John Halk had requested. Hayes had worked on Harding till midnight, badgering the candidate on the need for stronger, specific action on the ratification issue. All right, Harding finally agreed. You can send the messages. Over your name, not mine. So Hayes composed telegrams to the list of Republicans, including Herschel Candler and Emerson Luther in the Senate, Austin Overton and Harry Byrne in the House. And he pulled no punches.
Democracy in the United States is really nothing but a sham unless Election Day gives all Americans the chance to express their political opinion effectively, Hayes lectured the Republicans.
The 1920 election will influence our national life for at least the next 50 years, Hayes argued, and women must be allowed to take part in that decision.
To hold American women bound by the result of an election, to train them in schools and colleges to think for themselves as well as a man, to accord them freedom of utterance as a constitutional right, and then to attempt to deny them the opportunity to stand up and be counted on Election Day is a governmental blunder of the first magnitude.
Carrie Katz smiled when Harriet Upton showed her Hayes's emotional plea. Will Hayes sounded just like a good suff. And for that reason, Herschel Candler had no intention of listening to his advice. Across the hall in the Senate, Lon McFarland, in his linen suit and bolo tie, rose to speak. He had his own resolution to introduce. Speaker Todd nodded for him to begin.
"The men of Tennessee, noted for their integrity and chivalry," he read aloud from the text of his resolution, "and being desirous of doing in this case for their women as they always have in the past, and having the greatest admiration and respect for the intelligence of our home women."
Those who knew McFarland's discerning eye for the ladies smiled, but no one quite knew where he was going with this odd oration.
"And whereas there are numerous lobbyists, both female and male, from all sections of the United States at the present time in the city of Nashville, some being for and some against the ratification of the amendment," McFarlane pronounced in his smooth Tennessee drawl. "Be it resolved that we most respectfully and earnestly request all of the ladies and gentlemen, and also all of the men and women from outside the state who are interested in lobbying for or against this measure, to please go away and let us alone. We, feeling that we are fully capable and competent to fight our own fights without interference from any outside people whatsoever."
Back in the House, L.D. Miller stood again and moved to table Bond's delay resolution. Here was the first showdown, the first test of strength for both sides. If the anti-legislators could beat back this tabling motion, it would show they had the votes to delay, and possibly to kill, ratification. The galleries grew still. The roll call began.
"Mr. Anderson," the clerk called out.
"Aye," was the first response, in support of tabling the resolution, and the suffs murmured approvingly.
"Bell."
"Aye."
"Bond and Boyer." "No." The antis were pleased.
"Boyd, Bratton, and Brooks."
"Aye."
"Byrne."
"No."
"Carter."
"No."
Catherine Kenny kept a tally of the votes, mentally noting the men who had pledged to her canvassers to support ratification, but who were now throwing their support to the delay resolution. One lawmaker from Dayton had sworn 9 separate times.
"I'm with you, ladies, till they call the roll up yonder," he'd promised.
But now he was answering with the antis. More optimistically, Kenny noted, 4 anti-delegates had now voted with the suffs. Anita Politzer, who was keeping a similar tally for the Woman's Party, winced to hear the names of some of her East Tennessee Republicans, including Harry Byrne, among those opposed to tabling the measure. Their pledges, their word, had been worth nothing. The clerk moved down the roll.
"Hanover."
"Aye."
"Oldham."
"Then Overton."
"No."
"Riddick."
"Aye."
"Turner."
"No."
And finally,
"Speaker Walker."
"No."
The suffs did not have to wait for the clerk to announce his count. The delay resolution was dead. The suffs burst into cheers. The anti-spectators were stoically silent.
"The fight is won,"
Governor Roberts gloated.
"Victory for suffrage is certain."
Speaker Walker banged his gavel and adjourned the House for lunch. There was scant time for delegates to digest their hasty lunch before they were hit with the next anti-sally, a less nuanced, more lethal resolution introduced by Representative W.F. Story, prohibiting the legislature from taking any action on ratification until 1921, but it was held over until the next day. Joint Resolution Number 1, the ratification resolution itself, had already spent its overnight rest, and now Speaker Walker was obliged to send it to committee. He'd announced that he intended to send it to the House Judiciary Committee, chaired by his pal Billy Bond, but the outcome of the morning's vote demonstrated that Walker might face resistance to this move. He did. Walker reluctantly relented. The ratification resolution would be sent to the House Committee on Constitutional Affairs and Amendments, as it was in the Senate, and Walker named Thomas Riddick to chair the committee. Riddick was celebrated as an expert in constitutional law, and Walker's move appeared to be a generous gesture, but it was really a clever trap. Riddick, in only his 3rd day in the legislature, now held significant additional power, and Walker understood that this might not go down so well with some of the veteran delegates, even if they were suffragists. Walker was carefully seeding trouble. By late afternoon on Wednesday, the Hotel Hermitage was a hive of commotion. With both houses adjourned, assorted configurations of men and women, suffs and antis, Democrats and Republicans, held meetings, huddled in private, and hatched plans. Suffs congratulated themselves on their day's victories,
While antis dismissed the test votes as merely symbolic, no real measures of strength. They took courage in the communique they'd just received from their anti-brethren in the North Carolina legislature, signed by a majority of the lower body, promising a mutual pact to deny ratification. North Carolina lawmakers pledged not to inflict the 19th Amendment upon Tennessee and begged Tennesseans to do the same. The Tennessee antis also floated a trial balloon. They let it be known that the men of the Constitutional League were not at all pleased with Governor Roberts's performance in the House chamber that morning, working so strenuously on the side of the suffs, and might consider fielding an independent candidate to run in the fall election, siphoning off Democratic votes and weakening Roberts's chances. It was an appropriate punishment. They let the idea take off. During the afternoon and evening, the League of Women Voters workers were again sent out to find and take the political pulse of their assigned delegates. The legislators were under tremendous pressure from their party chiefs, their senior elected officials, their constituents. Adding to all this, they felt besieged by both suff and anti-advocates, who were chasing them, pestering with questions, giving them no peace. It's little wonder that the League women often returned from their assignments frustrated, reporting that quite a few of the delegates could not be found, or had skipped out on scheduled meetings. A favorite route of escape was the Jack Daniels suite. A constant stream of legislators and politicians came to consult with Mrs. Catt in her room, and quite a few of them had whiskey on their breath, which unnerved her. At times, the whole legislature seemed to be drunk. "Are none sober?" Catt asked incredulously. "Possibly," she was told. "Strike while the iron is hot," goes the old adage. So late on Wednesday evening, Tom Riddick and Andrew Todd announced that both the House and the Senate would vote on ratification on Friday. The votes appeared to be there, so why wait? But those keeping careful count with a more skeptical eye, including Sue White, recognized that things were not quite so rosy. While the suffs had mustered enough votes to defeat the delay resolution, they had amassed the bare minimum. 50 votes required for a constitutional majority in the House, the threshold that would be needed to ratify. There wasn't a single vote to spare. "The opposition has yielded by barely a hair's breadth," White warned, throwing cold water on the suffs' moment of joy. "And suffrage is not yet out of a hazardous position. The tabling of the referendum resolution was victory, but it is not the end of the fight. It will take further efforts and increased energy to accomplish ratification." That night, Alice Paul sent Abby Baker to extract those increased efforts from Governor Cox. The presidential candidate was in a buoyant mood after the day's events in Nashville.
"Boys, it looks like suffrage is going to go over in Tennessee after all," Cox told reporters at his evening briefing in Dayton. "I've just been talking with Governor Roberts over the long-distance telephone. He is very confident. He believes a favorable vote will be taken by Friday."
While Cox was meeting with reporters in his office, Abby Baker was left to cool her tapered heels in a nearby anteroom. Impatiently awaiting her turn, she grabbed the ears of a few reporters herself and gave them a very different view of the situation. She openly questioned Cox's blithe confidence in Governor Roberts's optimistic reports and Roberts's ability to deliver ratification on his own. She came armed with a portfolio of documents, including the latest intelligence from Sue White and Anita Politzer on the ground in Nashville, attesting to the volatility of the situation and the dangers that lay ahead. "Cox must switch around his campaign schedule," Baker insisted. "Go to Nashville immediately to take charge. He was relying too much upon an unreliable Roberts." And Baker was carrying another bit of information, intended to neutralize the claims Cox was undoubtedly hearing from some Southern Democrats, that woman suffrage would trigger an avalanche of Negro ballots, Republican ballots, spelling the demise of white hegemony and Democratic rule in the South. Baker carried her own statistics to reassure Cox. Census data showed that there were more white women in the southern states, 10.6 million, than black women and men combined, 4.3 million. It was an old and sad suffragist argument, but as Baker knew from her years of lobbying in Congress and the states, it often worked. Woman suffrage would not imperil white supremacy in the South or harm the presidential ambitions of James Cox, she promised. It was a late night and a bleary-eyed dawn for the Nashville combatants. Once Riddick and Todd announced plans for a Friday vote, there was little time for sleep. The Tennessee Suffs welcomed the promise of swift action. The Woman's Party workers were nervous about it, and the Antis were dismayed. But everyone knew they'd have to scramble to nail down the votes they needed within the next 36 hours. Most immediately, they were preparing for the expected morning showdown in the House over the Story resolution. If that passed, there would be no vote at all. And then for the joint House-Senate hearing that evening. The public hearing was shaping up to be a spectacular event, a kind of bare-fisted prize fight featuring an all-star card of Suff and anti-champions. The teams were still being assembled, the participants carefully vetted not only for their speaking prowess, but for their legal acumen, political clout, and popular appeal. It was reported that Governor Roberts might be on the Suff team, as well as Sue White representing the Woman's Party, and Ann Dudley punching for the Tennessee Suffs. The Antis were fielding notable judges, a U.S. congressman, and, of course, Charlotte Rao. Pyrotechnics were anticipated. Speaker Walker brought the House to order at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning. The chaplain prayed. The clerk called the roll. The galleries were full again. 94 members were at their desks. Governor Roberts was working the floor. The proceedings moved swiftly, and for the Suffs, successfully. When Delegate Story's resolution, prohibiting the current legislature from acting upon ratification, came up, the ratificationists moved quickly to table it, and the resolution went down in a voice vote. Over in the Senate, Lon McFarland withdrew his "Please Go Away" resolution, aimed at all outside lobbyists, before it came up for consideration. He gave no explanation for the action, but his colleagues were both bemused and relieved. Both houses adjourned to prepare for the evening debate. As the Senate dispersed, Ann Dudley found Lon McFarland walking in the Capitol corridor and approached him with a smile. "I'm not an outsider," she kidded him, as she affectionately leaned toward him to straighten his string tie. "I'm a Nashvillian born and bred, and if you want to honor Tennessee women as you say you do, the best way is to vote for ratification," she continued, as she nimbly pulled both ribbons of his tie even and firmed the knot. Tennessee men giving Tennessee women the vote. She thought that would appeal to McFarland's sensibilities. McFarland did not reply, nor did he back away. He simply reached into his jacket, pulled out his pocket knife, and in one motion sliced off the strings of his tie just below the knot. Dudley was left speechless, holding the limp strings in her hand, as McFarland walked briskly away. "Just keep it," he called over his shoulder. The anti-ladies now went for the jugular. From their headquarters in the Hermitage, they released a barrage of barbed propaganda publications, spiked with racist and sexist malice. Their material was only paper, but the words and images printed on those sheets had the lacerating proficiency of a serrated knife. Some were original creations, while others were adapted from recent anti-campaigns in other southern states, amounting to a roster of greatest hits. One was called "That Deadly Parallel," using facing columns to compare the provisions of the 15th and 19th Amendments, pinpointing their similarities and warning of renewed federal oversight of Tennessee elections and punitive enforcement measures, harkening back to Reconstruction days. This theme was continued by an advertisement labeled, "Shall History Repeat Itself? displaying a photograph of white women speaking with uniformed black policemen, and warning that Negro policemen may be appointed from Washington and sent to Tennessee to enforce the federal amendment. An equally dire tone was taken by The Dark and Dangerous Side of Woman Suffrage, a pamphlet expounding the detrimental effects of political equality upon marriage and the family. And this was amplified by perhaps Pearson's favorite piece, titled America, When Feminized. This poster featured a cartoon drawing of a hen wearing a Votes for Women sash across her breast, walking out the door, abandoning her nest and eggs. Her mate, the rooster, calls after her, "Why, Ma, these eggs will get all cold." She replies dismissively, "Set on them yourself, old man. My country calls me." The caption announces, "The more a politician allows himself to be henpecked, the more henpecking we will have in politics. A vote for federal suffrage is a vote for organized female nagging forever." The antis knew how to tap into the anger and confusion of Southern white American men at this nervous moment in 1920. Perhaps he'd returned from the war to find his job taken over by a black or immigrant man, or worse, a woman. Or maybe a machine was doing his job, making his skills obsolete. Even if he kept his job, his pay didn't provide for his family as it once did, as inflation eroded the dollar. Maybe his wife had donned coveralls and taken a paying job in a munitions factory during the war, learned to type and gone to work in a government office, or buttoned up a snappy uniform to become a streetcar conductor. She wasn't keen on coming home. Now she wanted to vote, even wanted to smoke, wanted everything a man had. After the vote, who knew what else she'd demand? The comfortable world he'd known was fast disappearing, and his sense of manhood was under siege. The antis seemed to understand him. Laura Clay and Kate Gordon were working hard, handing out the provocative anti-literature in the Hermitage lobby and Capitol corridors, while also buttonholing legislators sympathetic to their state's rights and Southern solidarity doctrines. The women's long experience as lobbyists served them well now and made them particularly effective anti-advocates. Harriet Upton, who'd worked with both Clay and Gordon for years in the National Association, felt a wave of sadness to see them wear the Red Rose uniform. When Clay and Gordon passed their erstwhile suffrage colleagues in the Hermitage hallways, they made no acknowledgement, pretending their former sisters in the cause simply weren't there. While Nashville was preparing for the evening debate, the mood at Woman's Party headquarters in Washington was tense and glum. "Tennessee rests as a heavy load on our minds," Alice Paul's secretary Emma Wold wrote to a staff member on Thursday. "Anita Politzer telegraphs that the vote will be taken tomorrow, and she has very little hope of a favorable result. We have been hoping that Cox would go to Tennessee, but Baker wires this morning that Robert still insists that ratification is safe and tells Cox it is not necessary for him to come. It is needless for me to say how stupid they all are, or how perfidious." The public committee hearing and debate was the hottest ticket in town on Thursday night. The House floor was jammed with legislators and office holders, judges and dignitaries, while the balcony was bursting with hundreds of suffs and antis decked out in their team's floral colors. Hundreds more people stuffed into the aisles and stood behind the railings and out the door. Governor Roberts sat near the front. Luke Lee and Edward Stallman were separated by a careful distance. The boisterous atmosphere was more akin to a baseball game played before rowdy fans than any staid legislative proceeding. And when Senator Lambert Estes Gwynne and Delegate Thomas Riddick, chairman of their respective constitutional committees, called the hearing to order at 8 p.m., they warned that no spectator outbursts or demonstrations would be tolerated. The lineups for both teams were being shuffled until the last minute. The leaders of both sides had initially planned that only men speak, so as not to ruffle the sensibilities of the more conservative lawmakers. But Charlotte Rao had demanded a speaking spot, and the anti-men reluctantly acquiesced. Then a woman should speak for the ratificationists, too, and Anne Dudley was selected by the Tennessee Suffs, while Sue White insisted that the Woman's Party be represented, so White's name was penciled in on the agenda. In the end, it was a more neutral Charles Williams who appeared as the envoy for the Suffs, but just in the role of introducing the program.
The women of this country have been fighting for suffrage for 60 years.
Williams began in a strong voice laced with her smooth, oval West Tennessee vowels. The veteran schoolteacher continued with a brief history lesson of the suffrage struggle in her home state, and concluded not with an argument, but with a plea, pitched to fall softly on the ears of the Southern gentlemen in her audience.
We have asked the men of Tennessee to take the matter of ratification and solve it for us, she declared, using language that must have made Sue White wince. We feel perfectly safe to place it in the hands of our own men. The eyes of the United States are upon Tennessee in this fight, and the women of the state and nation stretch out eager hands to our men in this fight.
Williams's damsel-in-distress trope was irritating to some Suffs, and probably maddening to Anita Politzer and Betty Graham. But in this event of political theater, it was the safest role for Tennessee Suffs to play. Now began the debate, with each side allotted 5 speakers and 90 minutes to make its case. The tenacity of the nettlesome, or, as the Suffs would say, trumped-up oath issue was obvious in the number of lawyers and judges tapped to argue the legal questions haunting ratification. For the antis, this was the ideal forum for presenting a scenario of disgraced honor and impending chaos. For the Suffs, it was an opportunity to shoot down those canards once and for all. The political realities were covered by Senator McKellar for the Suffs, hammering home the obligation of Democrats to follow their party platform and leaders, President Wilson and Governor Cox, to ratify. Tennessee Congressman Finnis Garrett, speaking for the antis, did his best to strike electoral fear into the hearts of all present by conjuring a disputed election in the fall. If Tennessee illegally ratified the Susan B. Anthony Amendment and the nation's women were allowed to vote, it would throw the election into another Tilden Hayes affair, he warned, referring to the 1876 debacle during which the results of the presidential election remained undecided for months.
You will place the election of our president, our congressman, our governor, our legislature, and every other election in jeopardy if you pass this amendment, Garrett prophesied, and the antis cheered.
But Garrett's apocalyptic scenario paled in comparison with the one evoked by Charlotte Rao.
Under the pretense of political expediency and the fond dream of woman's emancipation from the laws of nature, suffrage leaders are working to destroy the states and enslave the American people, Rao declared in her customary take-no-prisoners style. The federal suffrage amendment is a deliberate conspiracy to crush the will of the American public.
The antis in the audience bolted to their feet and clapped.
If the present legislature ratifies, it will be due to the Bolshevik and socialist influences at work on them, she insisted, and launched into a bitter tirade against Mrs. Catt and the Tennessee suffrage women. Though they were tempted to boo, the Suffs in the galleries just stuck their tongues out or made ugly faces at Rao, silently expressing their displeasure. The legislators would be wise
to keep the councils of honor and not the council of these women of Tennessee, Rao advised rather flippantly. We are living in perilous times, Rao warned. The destroyers are at work. The wreckers are at our homes. The Bolshevists are at your door and seeking the centralization of power. Tennessee has the opportunity to immortalize itself as the savior of the Republic, Rao declared, and redeem the principle of true representation and our union of states, without which American democracy must perish from the earth.
The Anti's delight in Rao's fire and brimstone oration was curbed just a moment later when General Charles Cates of Knoxville, who'd served as Tennessee's Attorney General for more than a decade, stood to speak on behalf of ratification. Cates immediately took the lady from New York to task for her slur on Tennessee women.
"When the men of Tennessee want to take lessons in honor, they will take them from the women of Tennessee," Cates chastised, to thunderous applause from the Suffs. "Let me say further to these distinguished ladies from outside the state who come here to preach against the women of Tennessee receiving the ballot. You can come here and preach to us for 1,000 years before you could make us believe the women of Tennessee had lost their grip on womanhood. There is no socialism or Bolshevism among Tennessee women," Cates thundered, and the Suffs roared. "The men of Tennessee trust their honor to their women," Cates rebuked Rao as the galleries shook with more Suff applause. "And they should not hesitate to trust them with the ballot."
There were two shocking moments for the Suffs during the evening's jousting match. The unpleasant surprises weren't delivered by the abrasive insinuations of Miss Rao or by the legal jujitsu of the anti-lawyers, but by a leaf of folded paper and the rap of a cane. When Judge G.N. Tillman of Nashville rose to speak for the antis, he slipped a sheet of paper from his jacket pocket, unfolded it, and began reading it aloud. It was a letter from Warren Harding, replying to a request from Tillman for clarification of Harding's position on ratification. The presidential candidate provided a startling reply.
"I quite agree with you that members of the General Assembly cannot ignore the state constitution," Harding wrote to Tillman.
Eyebrows were lifted all around the chamber.
"I should be very unfair to you," Harding continued, "and should very much misrepresent my own convictions if I urged you to vote for ratification when you hold to a very conscientious belief that there is a constitutional inhibition which prevents your doing so until after an election has been held."
At this, a few anti-legislators grinned, a few reporters looked quizzical, and all suffragists appeared extremely alarmed. Harding was giving credence and approval to the anti's legally dubious and discredited constitutional objections.
"I do not want you to have any doubt about my belief in the desirability of completing the ratification, but I am just as earnest about expressing myself in favor of fidelity to conscience in the performance of a public service. Under these circumstances, please say to Republican members that I cannot ask them to vote for ratification."
Gasps of delight, the antis, and disbelief, the Suffs, filled the chamber. The standard-bearer of the Republican Party had just given Tennessee GOP lawmakers permission to oppose ratification. More than permission, he seemed to be condoning rejection. The Tennessee Republican leaders, Hooper and Houck, felt a sudden chill and could only shake their heads in dismay. The morning papers would later describe Harding's letter as a body blow to the suffragists. The Suffs in the chamber had barely regained their composure from this jolt when they were knocked off balance by another tremor, announced by the tap of Edward Stallman's cane hitting the floor as he rose to speak. For the antis. Stallman looked the part of a successful man, with his still powerful frame dressed in a finely tailored suit, his silver hair well cut and carefully combed, his expensive cufflinks catching the light. His large head and firm features, together with the intensity of his blue eyes, projected the image of a man in control. He demanded attention, and every eye in the chamber was upon him.
"If you listen to these lawyers, you will still be in doubt when they get through,"